And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth. And yes, a great day to take a look at some of the greatest questions facing our country in general and every American as an individual. One of the great questions is, what is the path to happiness? Well, it turns out that there are a couple of new books that make the case that marriage predicts happiness better than your level of education, the kind of work that you do, or how much money you make or have been able to save. Your status as a married person, especially a married person with children, is a much more reliable path to satisfaction and happiness. There's a terrific review that has been written about these new books. It appeared in National Review. We'll be speaking to the author of that review, Madeline Kearns, coming up. But first off, I mean, one of the paths to happiness that President Trump has chosen has been making himself a passionate spokesman for the January 6th hostages. That's what he tends to call them. The people who were arrested and tried and either pleaded guilty or were convicted of some of the crimes of January 6th. Most of the people who are in jail, particularly the ones who are in jail in D.C., are actually guilty or were found guilty or pleaded guilty of assaulting police officers. But nonetheless, it's an amazing thing. President Trump has made the January 6th defendants central to his campaign. It is most likely, he said, that he would pardon, quote, a large portion of them as one of his first acts in office. Trump wrote last month that he would be freeing the January 6th hostages, as he puts it, who are being wrongly imprisoned. He also calls them political prisoners. Now, it can be difficult for journalists and the public to isolate which of the January 6th defendants Trump has in mind to get presidential pardons. However, he has taken a particular interest, according to reports, that he's interested in the defendants who were held in Washington, D.C. On March 22nd, Trump posted on Truth Social a flyer advertising a nightly vigil for the inmates held by the D.C. Department of Corrections. Quote, stand in solidarity with our January 6th political prisoners in the D.C. jail as we honor their bravery. That's what the flyer says. At 9 p.m., everyone stops what they are doing. This is according to the wishes of President Trump. At 9 p.m., everyone stops what they are doing to stand in solidarity as we all sing the national anthem together. Trump captioned the flyer with his own announcement of the vigil. Now, of the population of the January 6th inmates in D.C. jail, and there are lots more inmates in other institutions other than the D.C. jail, but 27 of the people who are in D.C. jail have been charged with assaulting law enforcement officers. 19 have been convicted at trial or pleaded guilty, and 8 more have been charged. 2 have also been charged, but not with assaulting officers. Instead, they are charged with committing other serious crimes. I find this that this could end up being a major issue, and the idea that it's going to be a winning issue for Donald Trump, that most people will agree with him that the especially when you actually look at the pictures and the bios and the stories of the people who were arrested, some of whom had fled the country because they knew they were going to get arrested, and then they were brought back, or they came back, or they were found after they were trying to evade capture and their hostage status. But it seems to me that this is truly problematic. And even though there are polls that show that a significant percentage of the Republicans who were self-identified believe that the January 6 riots were actually the work of the FBI or Antifa or somebody other than the people who were found guilty, that's just a segment of the Republican Party, and people are going to vote for Trump anyway. I think generally, if people are trying to figure out who's the candidate for me, it's hard to imagine that somebody who wasn't already committed to Donald Trump was going to say that I want to see these people pardoned after they attacked police officers and tried to sack the Capitol building. But there's another possibility that might attract somebody's vote, who basically said something remarkable that I think deserves direct attention. This is clip number one, Jeremy. Aaron Burnett was on the air on CNN with RFK Jr., Robert Francis Kennedy Jr., candidate for president. And she asked him, when people talk about the threat to democracy that Trump poses, do you really think that is equal to Joe Biden? Listen to this amazing answer by RFK.
That when people talk about the threat to democracy that Trump poses, do you really think that that is an equal to Biden?
Listen, I can make the argument that President Biden is a much worse threat to democracy. And the reason for that is President Biden is the first candidate in history, the first president in history that has used the federal agencies to censor political speech, so to censor his opponent. I can say that because I just won a case in the Federal Court of Appeals and now before the Supreme Court. It shows that he started censoring not just me. 37 hours after he took the oath of office, he was censoring me. No president in the country has ever done that. The greatest threat to democracy is not somebody who questions election returns, but a president of the United States who used the power of his office to force the social media companies, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, to open a portal and give access to that portal to the FBI, to the CIA, to the IRS, to CISA, to NIH, to censor his political critics.
Okay, do you censor his political critics, and which are the cases that he's talking about here? What's fascinating about this is everybody's trying to figure out that with RFK polling at above 10%, where are those votes going to come from? And with this kind of declaration that he believes that Biden is a bigger threat to democracy than President Trump, I think what that kind of indicates is that he might take some votes from President Trump, because obviously the both President Trump and RFK would take the position that President Biden is the worst threat to democracy on the ballot. So, meanwhile, what does his running mate say, I wonder? We will be talking about not political teams, but about life teams, marriage. Getting married and having kids, still the surest path to happiness? Research seems to say yes. We'll be talking to Madeline Kearns of National Review coming up.
Your daily dose of debate.
Give me more.
The Michael Medved Show. More of Michael Medved in a moment. We'll be right back.
And on the Michael Medved Show, it is a pleasure to welcome to the show Madeline Kearns, who is a staff writer at National Review. She is also a visiting fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, and she is the author of an extremely impactful and thought-provoking piece, which is actually a review of two new books we had on Brad Wilcox, the author of Get Married, which is about all of the benefits for society and for individuals of the institution of marriage. Her review includes that book and another book, which I haven't read yet, by Tim Carney, which is called Family Unfriendly. They both have the same punchline, which is the headline of her review, which is Getting Married and Having Kids is Still the Surest Path to Happiness. Okay, when taking a look at that title, my producer, Jeremy Steiner, who himself, just to make it clear, is happily married and two beautiful daughters and a wonderful wife and all of those good blessings. But he says, if getting married and having kids is still the surest path to happiness, why do Americans seem, according to most surveys, so dramatically unhappy and grumpy today?
Yeah, so thanks so much for having me. So really, there's been some good news and some bad news. The good news is that divorce is declining in the United States. And the bad news is that the explanation for that is that marriage is declining. And with it, the fertility rate. We know now that we don't have replacement level fertility. That's the amount of children you need to be born to keep the population at a healthy rate. We don't have that. And you're right, there's a decline in happiness. We've got mental health problems, more and more people feeling isolated and alienated. And actually, it turns out that the a great way to safeguard yourself from these types of vulnerabilities is a happy marriage. Happily married people report way better levels of satisfaction, of feeling content, of feeling secure than their unmarried or never married peers. And so the message, you know, I think the message that our conventional wisdom has had for a long time has been that marriage is a ball and chain and that it's better to go solo. We've had that message from the left, you know, with women especially saying that it just holds you back, career's where it's at. And for on the right now, we're seeing some figures say that for men, they shouldn't bother getting married because that's going to get in the way of their freedoms. And what the authors of these two books are saying is that's wrong. It's completely wrong. And the people who are ignoring that advice, they're the ones that are happy.
Well, again, and you can talk about, as you say at the very opening of your piece in National Review, by the way, which is linked at our website at michaelmedved.com, you make clear that right now, you could say happiness has been going down in the United States, that UN Gallup Survey Happiness Index. We are now 23rd in the world of happiness, right next to the United Arab Emirates. And among young people, people of prime marriage age, people below the age of 35, we are 62nd. And what's extraordinary is that, and we talked about this on the air, the state of Israel, with all of its challenges and all of the problems and all of the political tensions, is fifth overall in terms of the happiness index. And among young people, Israel is second to Lithuania, yeah, by the way. Does that surprise you?
Mm-hmm. No, it doesn't surprise me at all. You know, Israel has a great family culture, and that's something that Tim Carney talks about a lot in his book. And, you know, there's really two different views of marriage. You can see marriage as a status symbol, which is basically what it's become in the United States to a lot of people, something that you do at the end of, you know, getting your career sorted and getting some other things sorted and getting an established sense of self, whatever that means. You know, it's a status symbol. And, of course, status symbols are tend to be luxury items that, the middle class and the upper classes get, and not so much the lower classes, and that's what we're seeing play out. Or you can take the view that marriage is a cornerstone on which to build a fulfilling life, and it's a life that involves sacrifice and service and commitment to something bigger than yourself. You know, the authors use this phrase, we before me, in your attitude to your family. And that's what makes people happy. And certainly having children, it's a big demand. It's difficult, but that seems to be what's making people happy. And certainly we see that in the example of Israel.
One of the things that raised my attention reading your review of these two books was that it used to be that there was a very dramatic difference in terms of exit polling in presidential elections in this country, and actually elections at every level. People who were married, and people particularly who were married or had children, were almost in every election without exception more likely to vote Republican, more likely to vote conservative. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that the natural effect of having others dependent on you, or, you know, having your life not be all about you, is that you naturally see the importance of community. You naturally see the importance of institutions. You naturally see the importance of religion. Obviously, religion plays such an important role in family life and having a healthy marriage. And really, the dominant philosophy now is what the theologian Carl Truman calls expressive individualism. And that's the idea that human beings are defined by their individual psychological core, and that the purpose of life is allowing that core to find social expression in relationships. So it basically means that anything that challenges the self's desires is deemed oppressive. This is the progressive conventional wisdom, this idea that, you know, my life's about me and my identity and my expression and my desires. And that is really the complete opposite of a conservative worldview, or, you know, certainly a Christian worldview, where the most important thing is God, and then it's your family and it's your spouse and it's your children. And actually, it's counterintuitive, but that attitude, not being self-obsessed, not putting yourself first and making it all about you and trying to make decisions just based on you, that attitude of selflessness is what makes people happier. In fact, there's an interesting study one of the authors mentioned. He gives the example of married couples who share all their finances. So they have just a big pot, and it's the family pot. And then they're less likely to get divorced than the people who have separate bank accounts.
Well, that's all of this is tremendously important and actually very reassuring for people who do feel a commitment to the institution of marriage. By the way, something to add on that, but Madeline Kearns...
Michael Medved Show.
And on the Michael Medved Show, I mentioned one other thing that pertained to this question about marriage, and my question asked of Madeline Kearns, who was our guest from National Review, about the relationship between marital status, and this used to be a more intense difference than it is now, but it's still the difference that people who are married with children are more likely to vote Republican and conservative. And you can look at the elections, all of the recent elections, both before the Trump era and during the Trump era, and that tends to be the case. And one of the reasons, it always seems to me, is that reliance on the government is very different from relying on a family. And for people who are, for instance, single mothers or widows or widowers, if you're on your own, that's government is incredibly important. And there is a temptation, I think, and it's not a temptation, it's actually part of what makes marriage so wonderful, is that you're not necessarily counting on a bureaucrat or a new federal program or a decision made in faraway Washington or the way that the IRS is going to handle your tax obligations. All of that is less important when you have somebody else to rely on who one hopes is more reliable than Uncle Sam. And it's not Uncle Sam or Aunt Sadie. It's a husband or wife. And that is a very real and significant difference. Now, this is fascinating, and it's just breaking news as far as I understand it. Former Hawaii Representative Tulsi Gabbard, who has been talked about as a potential running mate for Donald Trump, was also talked about as a potential running mate for Robert F. Kennedy. Now, she, of course, is much better known because she ran for president before on her own as for the Democratic nomination back in 2020. She was a former member of Congress and Democrat from Hawaii. She has left the Democratic Party. She is now officially an independent. But she reportedly turned down the offer of running as the independent presidential candidate's Robert F. Kennedy's running mate, telling ABC News in a statement that she respectfully declined. Both former President Trump and Kennedy's campaigns have reportedly eyed Gabbard, who left the Democratic Party in 2022, as a possible 2024 vice presidential pick. Quote, "I met with Kennedy several times," she said, "and we have become good friends." That's what Gabbard said in a statement to ABC News. He asked if I would be his running mate. After careful consideration, I respectfully declined. A spokesperson for Kennedy's campaign did not immediately respond to Axios's request for comment. Okay. Then there is also this. This is a good email that came in, and it came in response to a column that I did for Substack. And by the way, would love you to enjoy and sometimes feel enraged, and sometimes respond to my Substack columns, which appear a couple of times a week. You just go to Michael Medved at substack.com. And I did a column about a new Pew study, which was one of those very thick things that ended up with about 20, 30 pages of public survey response information. And this was a survey that showed that, yes, most people in the country, our country, believe that Israel's reasons for going to war against Hamas were valid. 58% thought there were valid reasons for Israel to go to war. But I mentioned in my column, that's crazy. It's only 58%. I mean, you've been attacked. There are people who have busted across the border, actually knocked down all security institutions, and thousands of, quote, warriors who are terrorists who came in and killed 1,200 people and kidnapped another 250 people. And that's not a valid reason for war. How is Pearl Harbor a valid reason for war? Because that was an attack that was only against the military. This was an attack that was only against civilians, basically. Okay. And the amazing thing is that there are 41%. Yes, it's a minority, but it's a big minority who felt that Israel did not have valid reasons to go to war. So Mike writes in, and he says, "Well said, Michael. Thank you. So how does it come about that some 41% felt unwilling or unable to acknowledge the validity of Israel's existential struggle? Is it barely concealed Jew hatred? euphemistically called anti-Semitism, a generation lost in cultural relativity to believe there is no such thing as objective truth, or the intended result of an administration and media that hate Israel? I think it's a little bit of all of those things, except I don't really believe that this administration, the Biden administration, hates Israel. I don't think that's fair, especially considering the commitment that we've talked about already on this show about getting F-15s to Israel, which are very, very much needed. That's not a factor. Is it traditional anti-Semitism, which has turned out, according to all the surveys, to be deep and almost ineradicable? Yes, that's part of it. And it's also very much profoundly a part of a generation lost in cultural relativity, as Mike expresses it, to believe there is no such thing as objective truth. It's to believe there's no such thing as right and wrong. The idea that any struggle, whether it's against Nazis or against communists or against terrorists or against profoundly evil people like the bloodthirsty barbarians of Hamas or Islamic Nazism in general, again, how dare you say they're right or you're wrong? Because there is no right and wrong. Yes, there's that, but there's something else. And I think the giveaway is that the people who think that Israel did not have valid reasons to go to war are disproportionately young people. And this has been true of all of those demonstrations that have been from the river to the sea, all of Palestine will be free, and pounding the drums, all that. It has to do with what we have taught young people, which is to root for the underdog. And Israel is a successful, economically dynamic, well-educated, functional civilization. It's been a very fortunate country. The people who identify as Palestinians have never been able to put anything particularly workable together. Never. And so when you talk about the underdog, the support for the underdog helps to invalidate the idea that Israel was right to go to war. Meanwhile, the political wars all across the country will be right back on the Medved Show.
More of Michael Medved in a moment.
And on the Michael Medved Show, there is a reminder that, and it's a timely reminder because we have a super spring that we hope we're all enjoying, a special super spring sale. And that's to become a Medhead, a basic Medhead plan. The cost is almost unbelievably low because everything's 50% off right now. And you can become a Medhead member for the first year at a cost of $2.50 a month. That's pretty cool. When you think of that, and you work that out, that gives you annual membership, commercial-free. And the Michael Medved Radio Show podcast, you can listen on demand 24/7, and plus other material that we will post for Medheads. And then, even better, you can get a Medhead Plus membership also for 50% off. And that comes to about $4 a month, but that includes access to download any of the MedVed history programs. And that's a choice of, and you can eventually get to all of them, not all at once, but eventually, to a series of 100 different history shows that come to several hundred hours of inspiration and education and entertainment. Check it out at michaelmedved.com. I use the promo code MEDHEAD to get 50% off for the first year basic or the first year MedHead Plus membership, both 50% off. Go to michaelmedved.com now. Meanwhile, there is a report, and alarm bells were ringing on the right, says the New York Times. Why? Well, alarm bells are always ringing on the right. That's appropriate. But this one, after former president urged Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to, quote, finish up your war during an Israel with Israel Hayom, a conservative Israeli media outlet owned by GOP megadonor Miriam Adelson. It was founded, of course, by her late husband, Sheldon Adelson. One of the interviewers likened Trump's stance to that of President Biden, saying that both presidential candidates are turning their rhetorical backs on Israel. In contrast to congressional Republicans, Trump has not been unequivocally supportive of Israel since the war with Hamas began on October 7th, the New York Times reported. Also, the report here about what is going on across the country in terms of the Trump campaign. He's back at the campaign rounds today. He's in Wisconsin, a state that he lost by just 20,000 votes last time. And he won by 10,000 votes the time before in 2016. In any event, there was a little bit of a display of one of the reasons President Trump has so many problems with media, especially including CNN, who he thinks is the definition of fake news. There was a report on CNN, and listen to the way it was treated by the panel about Truth Social, Trump's media platform, losing lots and lots of money and going down in its stock value, et cetera, et cetera. Here is the way that sounded on clip five.
Truth Social stock tanked so fast, they're changing the name to Twitter. As a result of the stock tanking, Trump's net worth dropped $2 billion. Yep, Trump's so panicked, he's now selling copies of the Torah.
Shares of Trump Media and Technology Group, the parent company of Truth Social, plunged yesterday after a new SEC filing revealed the company lost more than $58 million in 2023. That compared to a $50.5 million profit in 2022. Donald Trump, who owns a majority of the newly public company, saw his own net worth tumble by more than $1 billion on paper. I don't think, how many Torahs would you have to sell? A lot of Torahs. to do $1 billion.
Larger than the Jewish market alone, let's just put it that way.
Okay, that was Jonah Goldberg's comments there. Stephen Colbert also talked about Truth Social. And here's what he had to say.
Messages that he posted were up on Truth Social. And there's some financial news about its lack of finances. According to new SEC filings from Truth Social, in 2023, on revenues of just $4 million, Truth Social lost $58 million. But how could that be? They have such a solid business model. Old rapist yells at Easter.
And talking about President Trump's Easter tweet storm or a Truth Social storm. Jimmy Kimmel spoke about that. Clip six.
Trump, by the way, had a very active holiday. He posted 77 times on Truth Social yesterday. Like, if that was your dad, you'd have him put away, right? One of the posts was this message of peace. He wrote, "Happy Easter to all, including crooked and corrupt prosecutors and judges that are doing everything possible to interfere with the presidential election of 2024 and put me in prison, including those many people that I completely and totally despise. Blah, blah, blah. Happy Easter, everyone." And on Holy Saturday, America's number one Bible salesman somehow found time to post this, the crucifixion of Donald Trump. That's right. You know, Jesus was treated unfairly, too. Some say the second most unfairly in history.
Meanwhile, there is a another source of entertainment, intriguing, dark, mysterious. A movie with one star who totally dominates the screen, Tessa Thompson. The movie, The Listener. Listen.
Now it's time for Medved's Entertainment Minute.
Tessa Thompson is terrific in a very unusual film in which she's the only character you actually see on screen. She plays a volunteer for an emergency help hotline where a variety of unseen voices tell her all about their troubles in The Listener.
It isn't about me. I'm just hearing their stories. They're the ones living them. I'm just here to listen.
This is directed by the well-known character actor Steve Buscemi. There are lots of fidgety details to try to make this film visually cinematic as the main character paces around, brushes her teeth, and goes to a window to look over an unidentified city in the distance. The desperate people whose voices and stories are compelling and intriguing, but without ever getting a glimpse of them, their complaints and pains seem more distant than intimate. Not rated, but should be R because of language and multiple discussions about suicide. 2.5 stars for the original and intriguing The Listener. And next time on the Michael Medved Show, a shocking piece from The Sun in Great Britain. They say that their reporting shows